or several countries can work together. With Iran, of course, we have a very strong cultural, historical and scientific collaboration. And of course, Pakistan and Iran can work together.
Iran's Deputy Science Minister Peyman Salehi told the meeting that OIC was established to strengthen unity and collaboration among Islamic countries. He offered the participants Iran's cooperation in the field of science and technology.
This collaboration between 15 countries may have a very fruitful outcome in the near future. Therefore, we arranged for the first meeting of ministers that will be held, I think, about 4 to 6 months later.
The Iranian minister further said that despite the sanctions imposed by the West, Iran is self-sufficient in the field of science and technology and has invested big in its infrastructure and commercialization of technology.
In 2021, Iranian scientists published about 78,000 papers, peer-reviewed papers in international journals. And at the moment, we are in the rank 15 in the world. We have established about 50 science and technology parks in Iran, more than 240 incubators, and so on.
Participants in the meeting discussed in detail the objectives, terms of reference and working procedures of the OIC 15 and recommended them for adoption by the ministerial committee, which is scheduled to be held in the near future.
The presence of Iranian officials in the OIC meeting shows that Iran is not dependent on the East or the West, and it's ready to boost its political and scientific cooperation with various countries across the globe. Nasir Kazmi in Islamabad.
South Korea's container and cement truck drivers are out in the cold, on strike with no extension to an agreement they say ensures safe cargo transportation and livable incomes. The union also wants tanker trucks, auto carriers, and delivery vehicles included in their deal. The strike action has widened to Seoul Metro Subway, with other transportation workers also threatening walkouts.
Believing in the government's commitment to the constitution and expansion of the safe freight system, we held off the strike and waited. But the system expires in a month, and the government's promise has not been kept. So we had no choice but to bring out our last card, the strike card.
Slowdown in construction and cargo delivery has already caused hundreds of millions in damages each day, with 5,000 truckers off the job. The slowdowns are rippling through South Korea's export-led economy as the strike enters its second week. President Yoon Suk-yeol this week ordered cement truck drivers back to work, with construction companies reporting losses into the tens of millions of dollars.
The foundation of our industries is in danger of being devastated. Even people's daily lives are being threatened. There is no way to justify the act of taking the lives of people and the national economy hostage to accomplish their own interest.
The Yoon administration has vowed to deal sternly with the illegal strike action.
The truckers were on strike just 5 months ago, but that strike only ended with the extension of the safe trucking freight rate system through the end of this year. With the government's back-to-work order, the truckers are threatened with fines and even jail sentences for those refusing to get back behind the wheel. Frank Smith, Wee Wang, South Korea.
Yemen is on the road to achieving self-sufficiency, with government plans and strategies aimed at doubling and expanding Yemeni agriculture and local food production. On this trip to a Yemeni farmland, I am accompanied by Wajih Al-Mutawakkil. The man is in charge of vegetable production in Yemen. Al-Mutawakkil is one of the government officials leading the campaign to revive Yemen's rich agriculture. He is here to show us the agricultural projects the government is funding.
We are now on the outskirts of Sana'a, right behind Sana'a International Airport, and beyond this point is where Yemen's agricultural renaissance is beginning to take place. Here, there's farmers that are planting crops such as garlic, onions, barley, and wheat. And these are crops that are vital to keeping the Yemeni economy afloat and keeping Yemenis from going hungry during this strangling economic blockade imposed by Saudi Arabia.
One of the ways to counter food shortage in Yemen is through the launch of water-based greenhouse projects.
These are the greenhouse projects we launched. There are about 8 on this farm. These are water-based greenhouses, which means we plant crops using gravel instead of soil. This gravel is extracted from the Yemeni mountains. This greenhouse project is made up of organic natural materials found only in Yemen.
Outside of these gas houses is an even more vital crop being harvested in acres of land that stretch beyond the horizon. Yemeni wheat. According to the Ministry of Agriculture, Yemen imports an estimated 4 million tons of wheat a year from foreign countries. To achieve self-sufficiency status, Yemen must produce its own wheat in order to eliminate its dependency on foreign imports. Farmers on the outskirts of the Yemeni capital are answering the call to produce more wheat.
This portion of the wheat is ready to be reaped, while the rest of the field is going to take another week to a week and a half before it is ready.
I like to take the wheat and grind it with my hands. Then I blow away the flax, and now it's ready for consumption.
As food production increases, many organizations have been formed to help achieve food security. Guan Foundation for Development in Agriculture is one of them. Guan Foundation educates Yemenis on the importance of helping the advance of the nation through agricultural initiatives. Guan also specializes in the production of basic foods from a combination of Yemeni seeds and grains at their local factory. They have even started their own brand of flour and healthy snacks sold in and out of the country. Guan's president believes that Yemen's high-quality agriculture must be revived in order to provide healthy food options for Yemenis and to eradicate some of the diseases caused by imported foods.
International organizations are playing and have played a large role in destroying Yemeni agriculture. They did so by exporting grain and wheat to us, which is often rotten and contains harmful substances like chemicals. Additionally, these grain shipments that enter Yemen have passed their expiration date, which results in a lot of illnesses.
After the revolution of September 21st in 2014, achieving self-sufficiency in Yemen is no longer an impossible task. According to Yemen's Ministry of Agriculture, if local food production continues to increase, Yemen could reach food security in just a few years.
The revolution against Western hegemony in Yemen was a starting point towards achieving self-sufficiency, which according to the Ansarullah leader is essential in order to secure food provisions for Yemenis. Yusuf Maudi, the outskirts of the Yemeni capital.
A chill has fallen on relations between Moscow and the Vatican City. The rift has been sparked by an interview published in a U.S. magazine on Monday in which the head of the Catholic Church, Pope Francis, condemned, quote, the cruelty of some minority groups of soldiers, namely the Chechens and the Siberian Buryats, in the Ukraine's conflict. On Tuesday, Moscow's ambassador to the Vatican, Alexander Avdiiv, lodged an official complaint in response. Pope Francis' remarks were made during an interview with America, a Jesuit magazine headquartered in New York. When asked about his apparent reluctance to directly condemn Russia for the war in Ukraine, the pontiff said in response that he received much information about the cruelty of the troops. The Russian ambassador to the Holy See, Avdiiv, expressed anger at the pontiff's quote, insinuation of alleged atrocities by the Russian military during the course of the special military operation in Ukraine. The ambassador also stressed that nothing can shake the cohesion and unity of the multinational Russian people. The Russian Foreign Ministry also dismissed Pope Francis' comments.
What will the Vatican tell us about the martyrdom of the multinational Soviet people? Maybe it makes sense to first discuss Catholic penance for the 20th century for the Orthodox and for Muslims for the many centuries before that. This is no longer Russophobia. It's a perversion of the truth on a level I can't even name.
Earlier this week, Moscow had welcomed the Vatican's announcement of mediation to bring an end to the Russian-Ukrainian war. Some fear that this could no longer be viable after this diplomatic incident.
I don't think this tense moment will change the Vatican-Russia relations substantially. Moscow still expects the Holy See to position itself as a mediator in the conflict with Ukraine. But whether the mediation takes off will very much depend on Kiev and largely on the U.S.
On Sunday, top Vatican diplomat Archbishop Paul Richard Gallagher had said the Holy See and Pope Francis are ready to provide space for peace negotiations on Ukraine. However, after the announcement, Moscow said Kiev is against any peace talks. Max Civili, Rome.
In the United States, many spent their Thanksgiving holiday not in gratitude, but in grief, as mass shootings and violent crime continue to plague the nation. Many are lost in confusion, trying to explain why there have been over 600 mass shootings so far this year, a pace just below the all-time record. In only Chicago, the nation's third-largest city, 8 people were killed and at least 30 wounded by gun violence over the holiday weekend.
Everybody's always talking about how dangerous this city is, how unreasonable it is to live in America because of how much crime there is. Crime rates are actually about the same. What changes is how much funding are we getting? How many schools are closing? How many resources do people have? And when you actually don't actually invest in this with a growing population, that's, of course, going to cause more crime.
The Democratic Party is about to hand over control of the House of Representatives, and they are being widely criticized for refusing to pass stricter gun laws when they had the chance. Republicans are likely to defend gun ownership, and they eked out a midterm legislative victory with a major emphasis on violent crime.
No matter what grievances you bring up, no matter what facts you throw at any congressperson, Democratic or Republican, right, their idea is to fund the police more. But this is money that should be going to the public. This is like, for example, here in Chicago in 2020, the mayor asked the public, like, hey, how would you like to sort the budget out? And 80% of the people voted that, hey, we should defund the police and put that money back into other things that could really help out the community.
Crime data in the United States is often late or unreported, but what is certain is that since the coronavirus lockdowns, murders have increased by at least 30%. But what statistics cannot capture is the widespread sentiment that the violence in today's United States is more brutal, shocking, and random than it was in years past. While the U.S. is by far the most armed nation per capita, other countries have high rates of gun ownership, but not the regular violence which makes American life uniquely precarious and fearful. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willst, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah,
give me on every Monday two favors from thee. The facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to The Spotlight. I'm Kavit Akhwayi. When it comes to the UK, the headlines couldn't be worse, and in some cases, shocking. For example, UK Royal Mail workers and university lecturers begin fresh strike as inflation skyrockets. Or another headline, Britons turn to pet food amid cost of living crisis. Well, in this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at whether things are as dire in the UK as it seems to be, and as the headlines indicate, and whether the government headed by the multimillionaire Prime Minister Sunak's austerity budget can even come close to fixing the UK's economic crisis. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Saeed Mohsin Abbas joins us. He's a journalist and political commentator from London. Also joining us is Clive Menzies, researcher and political economy analyst, also joining us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. I'll first start with you, Clive Menzies. Taking a look at how things are in the UK, obviously the headlines paint a doomsday scenario, but as we keep getting news, it just seems like it's getting worse. For example, the latest being that things are likely to get worse before they get better. This comes from the Bank of England, which is why I'm introducing this to you in form of a question, where it says it's predicting a lengthy downturn. And in addition, Britain was the only group of seven economies yet to recover fully from the COVID slump. Are things as bad in the UK as the headlines are indicating?
Well, I think the question is phrased in terms of relative growth by inference, saying that Britain is taking much longer to recover. But I think this is much less to do with competition between countries and much more to do with something far more overarching, which is essentially, we've been predicting this collapse and hyperinflation for some years now because of the way in which central banks have been printing money like there's no tomorrow. And it's quite instructive that I think the alarm bells were ringing in the summer of 2019. Mark Carney, who was very much part of the architect of this crisis in waiting, resigned from the Bank of England on the 15th of March 2020 and gave a hospital pass to the rather intellectually challenged Andrew Bailey, who as recently as July 2022 was saying that our job is to keep inflation at 2% and that's what we'll do. Clearly, the Bank of England's economists, and more importantly, the governor of the Bank of England, hasn't a clue as to how this all came about. But those who were disinterested and not part of the club that are benefiting from what's been going on over the last 3 years could see this coming a mile off. In terms of how bad things are, we were predicting back in the summer that in the autumn things were going to get very bad and we're going to go through a very deep economic crisis. But the good news is that increasingly there is visibility of the corruption and criminality, the amount of money that has been laundered, for want of a better way of putting it, through this manufactured COVID crisis, the climate narrative, which is also false and has been used under the cover of COVID to basically turn cities into ghost towns. I spent most of my time during the so-called pandemic moving around London as I normally would, and the place was deserted. So in terms of economic crisis, it's no wonder when they deliberately collapsed the economy.
All right. Well, Seamus and Abbas, I don't know if you agree with what Clive Menzies there said, but one thing that caught my attention, I want to ask you, is that there was a certain class there that was aware that the UK economy will be at least facing the situation that it is, and it made off from this and profited from this. Because some things don't make sense, like the GDP of the UK registering at $3 trillion or over $3 trillion. But yet, you know, you're having what you're facing right now. So something maybe is not making sense. And, of course, there are guests also talking about how, you know, it may be the rich that are really making out here, generally speaking. I mean, this figure in terms of the GDP and the fact that the UK is facing what it's facing really is, it points to a great economic inequality, which the UK has been plagued by.
Well, Britain is the biggest offshore tax haven, and it has the Corporation of London, the City Square Mile, which is one of the biggest money laundering regions in the world. It acts essentially as a place where the rich and the powerful and the corporate sector hides its money, does its dirty deals. Most of it is beyond the law. In fact, that square mile has its own jurisdiction, everything from the Lord Mayor that presides over it through to their police there, through to whether the British government can even ask questions of those huge corporations and the huge amounts of money that pass through there. And London itself has become really, it's awash with dirty money from every corner of the world. And yet, at the same time, that same Corporation of London actually has probably 30%, if not more, Clive might correct me, of the hold on the GDP of this country. So they can switch off the button in Britain very, very easily if these huge players are upset in any way, or if the British government doesn't toe the line of the City of London. Westminster has far less power, I would really argue, than that corporation itself. So that's one thing. But that controlled demolition of the economy, which Clive certainly hinted at, if not started opening up on, you only have to look at the sequence of events. You know, when they first flooded Britain with migrant workers from Poland and from Europe, I mean, there was a huge sort of issue at the work front at that time. But then what they've gone and done is the Brexit thing. They've done the migrant restriction on labor. They've gone into this Ukraine war without thinking. They're part and parcel of the US sanctions on Iran and other places, so they can't do business. Their own companies can't do business with major economic powerhouses around the world. The COVID overreaction and the way they dealt with that was diabolical in and of itself. And of course, the background to all this is the Great Reset, which we can't ignore. The context of all of this is that actually globally, this idea of digital money coming through, the idea of totalitarian economy, China-style, if you like, the emergence of AI. There are a lot of things that are, that the big, rich, and powerful money mafia, as I describe them, want to happen. And part of it is to really teach people a lesson, bring down their expectations, have them at each other's throat with economic worries while they get on quietly over the next 10 years, continuing to readjust the entire economic and political, if you like, landscape according to their requirements.
Okay, well, you just mentioned Brexit there amongst your statements, and I have to ask you, Clive Menzies, about what the British Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, has said on trade. Let me be unequivocal about this. Under my leadership, the UK will not pursue any relationship with Europe that relies on alignment with the EU laws. He says, I voted for Brexit, I believe in it, and I know that Brexit can deliver. But Brexit has not delivered. So why is he beating the drums on something that seems to be a failed policy at this point?
Well, the whole Brexit debate is worthy of a program at least on its own, because there was no Brexit, there is no Brexit, there will never be any Brexit as long as this existing structure persists. What we had was all the things that were a matter of convenience for ordinary people like me to travel and to do business in other countries. Those have been restricted. But we are in lockstep with European policy on Ukraine, on finance, on law, on everything. So what Rishi Sunak is claiming is an outright inversion of reality. And this is a charade or pantomime that's been played ever since 2016, where I would have suggested in hindsight that the election of Trump and the referendum on Brexit were primarily to divide the 99% who were beginning to realise that we weren't run by governments and there was no political reality, that actually money power rules everything. And in order to fragment that coming together, if you like, both Trump and Brexit were very effective in dividing populations down the middle. But the reality is there is no Brexit. It's an illusion. And what Mosin was referring to in terms of this great reset, this is all in lockstep. Everything's happening together. So any pretense that, you know, we're not doing as Europe are doing, I mean, you only have to look at the Netherlands and the way they're closing down farming, and they're doing the same over here. This is a war on us all, and this is a war between centralized power, which is primarily, as Mosin says, in the hands of those who control money, and the rest of us. And most people are unaware that we're in this war, but increasingly I'm finding on the ground that more and more people are awakening to this. So their plans are not going to work, and that's good key. News that we can take away from this.
Exactly, and that's key, said Mohsin Abbas. To put it into a couple words, people power. Taking a look at what the strikes are going on in the UK on a variety of sectors, the ambulance strike we're looking at, the UK Royal Mail workers, the university lecturers are the most recent strikes amongst a host of other sectors that have gone on a strike in the UK. Now, you know, these people are not, I mean, this is basically because of the inflation, their pay is not keeping up with it. So isn't the government worried about this, or should I say, aren't the people in the higher echelons, the 1%, worried about the fact that people are going to turn against them?
Well, I imagine they are worried. But at the same time, there's one thing that you often see. That these folk who are at the in that upper echelon, they tend to profit whether there's chaos, conflict, war, or peace. They always seem to be, in some way, pulling the strings. One hopes that, as Clive, in a lot of his research, has put together this notion of withdrawing consent. One hopes that if the public awakens and they withdraw consent from these exploitative, usurious, quite psychotic institutions and individuals that are in control, then there's a hope. And of course, those people, if they did wake up to this reality, then what they're trying to implement on the ground, which is that in birthplaces like Burnley today, we've got 50% of children who are living in absolute poverty, according to certain definitions of poverty, which is, I think, below 60% of inflation-aligned median income. That was in 2010-11. But things like this, things like old people now having to turn off their heating, you know, skipping lunches, you know, not having holidays anymore, having to spend their savings in feeding kids. These are all realities on the ground which are already hitting home. And if they carry on, then one hopes that people will dig deeper as to why this is all happening, and they will react and respond. And these strikes are no bad thing. This awakening of people in terms of realizing that the political economy is geared towards the billionaires, who we all know became, and it's all proved that they became hugely rich during COVID and post-COVID. So it does seem as though even now Rishi Sunak is taking it easy on those rich folk, because they're not, I mean, their tax reliefs, et cetera, the caps are being taken off. They're allowed to sort of do what they like. And whilst they may be trying to soften the impact of energy prices, waking the people up and creating, you know, huge problems for the government, it may not be enough. People may hopefully wake up and see that the actual systemic problems will not go away by trusting the established structural elite, as we often say.
You mentioned the town was Burnley, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Burnley. I'm going to ask you, Clive Menzies, when it comes to some of the testimonials here, because we have to cover this. Skipping lunch each day and watching TV in blankets to keep warm is not how this couple really imagined their retirement to be. Rationing cups of tea in the face of soaring energy bills, of which Burnley, happening in Burnley now, one of the most deprived areas in Britain, are spending more of their income on essential goods. It has seen the sharpest increases in prices than elsewhere. Are we looking at this as being the worst case scenario, just unique to this particular town, or is it widespread in the UK?
I'm sure that the people who have been playing by the rules of what Mosen described as the money mafia, because they set the rules. The whole economy is geared around harvesting people's energy and resources and whatever wealth they can accumulate. And basically, there will be a lot of people who will suffer as a result if they continue to play by the rules. But what is actually happening is that people are beginning to realize that things like council taxes, utility bills, and debt are optional as to whether you repay them, because the whole system has been created to harvest our energy and resources, and people are beginning to wake up to that. And I've not been able to verify this, but a sizable swathe of the population in the north of England has ceased paying their council taxes. And this is just the beginning. And, you know, I won't go into the lawfulness of council tax, but it is unlawful, and more people are beginning to realize that. So there are many ways in which people are fighting back. And the way that people will be able to work through this and begin to thrive is by forming communities separate from the structures and the authorities that they live under. Because there is, you know, an economic crisis doesn't destroy anything other than money. And money isn't worth anything. It's the food and all the infrastructure and all that we need to live on that is important. And people are forming their own groups and communities to provide health care, to resist the unlawful demands of the system, and to grow their own food. This is all beginning to happen. Food cooperatives, cutting out the retailers from eggs, for example. There are farmers who produce eggs, and the supermarkets play them so little that it's not worth their while to produce them. Well, now sure. Communities are forming to go direct to the farmers. So this system is going to be bypassed and it's going to collapse, but it's going to take time and there's going to be death and destruction in the meantime.
Well, I mean, it's getting pretty bad here, say Mohsen Abbas, when you're having reports such as people resorting to eating pet food come out in the news and making the news. So it's got to be pretty bad at this point. Now, you're looking at the Chancellor of the Exchequer saying that poor households should be spared much of the pain and cuts to public services. But then you have the central government funding for Burnley, since we're talking about that town, to have fallen by £5 million a year since the year 2013 through 14. That's about a third. Now, if that's happening to the poorest of towns, then that's a pretty bleak picture. Does Rishi Sunak understand, or through his exchequer understand, the depth of desperation that towns like Burnley are in?
I think they fully understand. I think that they take their orders, as we say, from forces much higher than them. And once you have that scenario where Britain is having to go in line with the policies that are being set by corporate money mafias that are outside of Britain, and they are essentially usurping the British electorate's democratic, you know, rights, and they are usurping Britain's independence, economic independence and political independence, essentially. That's what they're doing. But it's all being done in an underhand way in the background. So the fact is that Rishi Sunak and these people and the government itself, I believe the civil service, I mean, they've been in this business for centuries. They know very well how things work and how the Treasury certainly isn't, you know, some would say they might be manned by half-wits, but I rather suspect that they do know, but they are under orders to run the policies that they are and have been. So the net result really is, you know, at the end of the day, you've got inflation 12% rising over the last year. And don't forget, the austerity that was going on during the Tory term over their term here has been ongoing already. And there were huge, before COVID, certainly there were huge rallies that were picking up against the Tory austerity lie, as it were. And those are now obviously going to return, I think, in a much bigger way, one hopes. But what's more important is that people need to look more deeply about the elitist classes which have been constantly put back in power. If Starmer from the Labour Party comes into power, he's not any better. He's also beholden to exactly the same systemic corruption. And it's a nonsense that where these two-party systems in most of the democratic world try to fool people that in some way there is some choice, and they play this kind of good cop, bad cop, right. You know, austerity versus releasing the burden on the masses. This game has gone on long enough, and I think that it's high time people really woke up to the fact that there needs to be systemic deep change in the way we operate our political economies.
Okay. Well, both of you have mentioned this great reset. Now, I'm assuming the reset, Clive Menzies, is the one that the WEF put into motion, not put into motion, introduced or got some coverage that was of a major degree across the media, in a sense. Is that the great reset we're talking about, where it's to green energy? And my question, aside from that, is how the U.S. is playing a role in leading Europe down a path where it's actually but it's affecting the industries and factories in Europe as a whole through its initiative, which is green in nature in terms of the Inflation Reduction Act, where companies from Europe are relocating to the U.S. Can you put that into the Great Reset scenario for us, if you can?
In a short time, that's quite difficult. But I think when Mosin talks about choice, the late great George Carlin, comedian, said, it's a big club and you ain't in it. You don't have choice, you have owners. And essentially, the fact that, you know, we can refer to the US and the US and Europe having some sort of competition, and certainly with what's been happening with the sanctions in Russia, Europe has been sort of thrown in at the deep end, and it's going to suffer severely and has been made to commit some sort of energetic or economic suicide as a result. So there is this inter-country competition, but this is universal. You know, the Americans are suffering or will suffer no less than Europeans and Brits and anybody else who's caught up in this Great Reset. But the Great Reset is about recasting the way in which the world works, because the game that has been played for centuries is that when, in order for economic growth, you go and plunder other countries. Well, all the countries have been plundered. There are now too many people, in their view. There aren't too many people if we had a rational economic system.
Right.
But in their view, because it's a hunger games economy where there are always more losers than winners, then they're resetting the turf, one, to reduce the population, and the green agenda is very much part of that. Net zero doesn't mean net zero carbon, And, you know, we are carbon life forms. It means net zero people. In other words, let's reduce the number of people. So that's part of it. The other part of it is actually because there are more people than there are functional jobs to do, and there are many jobs that actually don't actually produce wealth, then it's about substituting, as Mosen said, AI and robotics for people. Sure. So this is all part of the Great Reset, but it's a big complex issue that needs much more time.
Definitely. What a bleak world we live in. A final question, say Mohsen Abbas, looking up UK economic crisis through the software we have for news here, the thing that came up was how you have Britain's Prince William, Prince of Wales, and Catherine, Princess of Wales, arriving for the 2022 Earthshot Prize ceremony at the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library and Museum in Boston, Massachusetts. Now, you would think if the UK is mired in an economic crisis of this proportion that we just covered, it seems like the priorities are misappropriated when it comes to, let's say, the prince. Am I correct to put it that way? Less than a minute.
I think we can say that royalty is part of that elitist structure. They're the most visible, and they get easily, of course, targeted. But in reality, if you were to go to the clubs and private accommodations in Mayfair of most of this elitist mafia in London, they're not going to be affected by the bread prices and by the prices of milk going up the way they are. They're not going to be affected by energy or heating. Okay. They don't care. The reality is it's the poor man, it's the people on the ground that are suffering, and they need to really fight the resistance economy. Globally, resistance economy, fighting the system in that way is necessary now.
Thank you so much. Sorry to cut you. We're just fresh out of time. Sam Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator, Clive Menzies, researcher and political economy analyst. Thank you to you both. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikova Tapwe and the team, it's goodbye.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Russian news agencies are saying former U.S. intelligence contractor Edward Snowden, who fled prosecution after revealing highly classified U.S. government surveillance programs, has received a Russian passport and taken the oath of citizenship. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Associated Press has covered this story. Former U.S. intelligence contractor Edward Snowden, who fled prosecution after revealing highly classified surveillance programs, has received a Russian passport and taken the oath of citizenship, according to Russian news agencies, quoting his lawyer on Friday. Lawyer Anthony Kucherena was reported as saying that Edward Snowden got the passport and took the oath of allegiance on Thursday, about 3 months after Russian President Vladimir Putin granted him citizenship. The reports did not specify whether Snowden has renounced his U.S. citizenship. The United States revoked his passport in 2013, leading to Edward Snowden being stranded in a Moscow airport for weeks after arriving from Hong Kong, aiming to reach Ecuador. Russia eventually granted him permanent residency. He married the American citizen Lindsay Mills in 2017, and the couple have now 2 children. In Washington, State Department spokesman Ned Price said on Friday that The United States was aware of reports that Edward Snowden had finalized his Russian citizenship but could not confirm them, and referred questions about his status to the Russian government. However, Ned Price said the Biden administration would not be surprised if the reports were indeed correct. Mr. Snowden has long signaled his allegiance to Russia. This step would only formalize that, Ned Price told reporters. Edward Snowden leaked documents on the National Security Agency's collection of data passing through the infrastructure of U.S. phone and internet companies. He also released details about the classified U.S. intelligence budget and the extent of American surveillance on foreign officials, including leaders of countries allied to the United States. Edward Snowden says he made the disclosures because he believes the U.S. intelligence community had gone too far and infringed on civil liberties. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered this story and gives us more detail. Edward Snowden has received a Russian passport after swearing an oath of allegiance to the country that has sheltered him from US authorities since 2013, his lawyers have said. Edward Snowden, a 39-year-old, a former intelligence contractor who leaked secret files, was granted Russian citizenship in an order signed by Russian President Vladimir Putin in September. On Friday, Edward Snowden's lawyer, Anatoly Kucherena, said Snowden had received his passport. He took the oath of allegiance, he said. The decision has come at an extremely inauspicious moment. Anatoly Kucherena said on Friday that Edward Snowden was happy and that Russian citizenship would prevent him from being extradited to the United States. He, of course, is happy and thankful to the Russian Federation for his citizenship. He's now a fully-fledged citizen of Russia, Kucherena said. And most importantly, under the Russian constitution, he cannot be given up to a foreign state. Kucherena could not immediately be reached for further comment. In Washington, State Department spokesman Ned Price said the United States was aware of reports that Edward Snowden had finalized his Russian citizenship, and said the Biden administration would not be surprised if the reports were in actual fact correct. Mr. Snowden has long signaled his allegiance to Russia. This step would only formalize that, Ned Price told reporters and journalists. Individuals receiving Russian citizenship are required by law to pledge to observe the constitution and legislation of the Russian Federation, the rights and freedoms of its citizens, to fulfill the duties of a citizen of the Russian Federation for the benefit of the state and society, to protect the freedom and independence of the Russian Federation, and to be loyal to Russia and to respect its culture, history, and traditions. Edward Snowden's wife, Lindsay Mills, is also said to be applying for Russian citizenship. They live at an undisclosed location in Russia with their two sons, who were both born in Russia. Edward Snowden wrote in September, "After years of separation from our parents, my wife and I have no desire to be separated from our sons. After 2 years of waiting and nearly 10 years of exile, a little stability will make a difference for my family. I pray for privacy for them and for us all." VOA News has also covered the same story and gives us more detail. Former US intelligence contractor Edward Snowden, who exposed the scale of secret surveillance by the National Security Agency NSA, has sworn an oath of allegiance to Russia and received a Russian passport, according to Russia's Itatas news agency. "Yes, he got a passport, he took the oath," Anatoly Kucherena, Edward Snowden's lawyer, told the Itatas news agency. Snowden, a 39-year-old, did not immediately reply to a message seeking comment on the report. Russian President Vladimir Putin in September granted Russian citizenship to Edward Snowden, who fled the United States after leaking secret files that revealed the extensive eavesdropping activities of the US government and even eavesdropping on world statesmen and countries which are allies to the United States. Defenders of Edward Snowden hail him as a modern-day dissident for exposing the extent of US spying. Opponents say he's a traitor who endangered lives by exposing the secret methods that Western spies use to listen in on hostile states and on militants.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.